Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Working Behind the Scenes. Coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by Justin Smith, the Senior Vice President with Lee & Associates and the author of the recently released book, Industrial Intelligence, The Executive's Guide for Making Informed Commercial Real Estate Decisions. Justin will join us to discuss a bit about supply chain as it pertains to retail, particularly with warehouses and how warehouses have been difficult to find to house distribution and fulfillment centers for retail. He'll also talk about the typical process a retailer goes through in terms of locating those facilities and then putting them into use in their system. Speaking of supply chain, we'll also address Home Depot taking shipping matters into their own hands. And in news, we'll discuss RH, formerly Restoration Hardware's, earnings last week. A quick reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Spotify or iTunes, Apple Podcast, etc. Those ratings, if you enjoy the show, certainly help others to seek us out, other retail-minded individuals, if you will. Additionally, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, where I just uploaded a picture of a Blockbuster strip center. The strip center still branded after Blockbuster, despite the fact that Blockbuster left many years ago, that actually in New Mexico. So let's get to the one-time Restoration Hardware, now RH, as they released earnings this past week. The company continues to see success after their turnaround plan of 5 years ago, and that's something honestly both Leighton and myself called into question at the time. 5 years on, we can say easily that we were terribly wrong, as we are about most things, as the company did manage to capitalize on their momentum of 2018 and 2019, at least on the margin front, to take advantage of those nesting consumers during the pandemic. Additionally, back in 2016, moved to that membership model that now provides such benefits to members as to ensure that basically, if you buy one piece of furniture from RH, you can't afford to not join as a member. Basically, their aim over the last few years has been to continue to refine their brand as an upper echelon retailer, moving away from outlet sales and lower price goods. You'll recall they closed several outlet stores throughout the country. Haven't really done so over the past few years, but really focusing on that luxury segment and with it, the luxury consumer segment. So the numbers, despite their relative sales success during the pandemic, we should be mindful that their sales were down 18% during last year's first quarter as a result of consumer uncertainty, as a result of store closures or showroom closures in their case. As with many retailers, at least so far in Q1 of 2021, sales rebounded in a big way for RH. They saw a company-wide sales increase of 78% during the quarter. And because of their kind of showroom model, they have more showrooms than they do, say, outlet stores. They look at demand as a relevant metric rather than seeking out those same-store sales metrics numbers. Demand for their RH core brand increased 109%. Over last year. Operating margin also popped from 10% even of sales last year to an eye-popping 22.6% this year. That's something actually they expected to be even better in the second quarter. Again, long-term goal for the company is to get that margin above 25% on a consistent basis, which they feel they can only do if they are firmly ensconced in that luxury segment. So that operating margin, of course, in turn fueled an increase in adjusted earnings per share from $1.27 last year to $4.89 this year. Net income was 15.2% of sales, which is also impressive. And they repeated the quote on the call, luxury margins come with luxury retail. And we certainly saw that to be the case for them in this quarter. By the way, that earnings per share, that was a beat on analyst expectations by 69 cents or 16%. Now, their plan of the late teens focused on margin above else, as we've alluded to, and sure enough, they've been delivering exactly on that front. taking a step back a little bit, taking a historical perspective, their gamble was essentially that the placement of their brand as a premier or ultra premier one might bring fewer overall customers, so maybe lower traffic, in other words, but it would allow them to capture higher margins on what they do sell. Lately, though, they've benefited from solid traffic, whether it's pandemic-driven or brand-driven, in addition to those higher markups that they're seeing. But one thing that was somewhat refreshing on this call was that the company was very quick to credit macro-level trends for not only their sales success in the first quarter, but also their expectations for the rest of the year. They raised their second quarter expectations, as I mentioned, to reflect margins above 25%. In fact, in the 26% range, they see revenue growth coming in Q2 around 35 to 37% over last year. And they went on to say that they've always seen the year as kind of a tale of two halves, where they feel as though year over year, at least quarter one and quarter two will perform better than the back half of the year. They are seeing strength in overall industry indicators that makes them think that perhaps this growth is more of a long-term thing. Perhaps it's got a longer tail. Speaking of long tails, for them, those macro trends, that means the housing and renovation market, they cited that on the call as having a long tail, of course, and pent-up demand as well. And you know, it's kind of difficult to parse how much of the current housing demand is driven by investors versus owner occupants. You hear different things from different markets, certainly, but one thing is for sure, we know housing inventory in many cities throughout the country is low. RH feels as though benefits will be reaped regardless whether inventory is low and that forces people to renovate their current homes or whether people are purchasing new houses on the market. RH leadership also noted low interest rates on the call. Now, we should mention for a lot of consumers out there, it's actually getting more difficult to get a mortgage, more difficult to get a home loan. But keep in mind, that's not the segment of the population that RH is really serving. RH, of course, serving that luxury customer. That luxury customer more likely to have access to those low interest rates. Stock market strength also helping out RH, according to the company. Again, those luxury customers more likely to maybe have some of that money invested and feel confident when they see that stock market pop. Also, potentially a roaring 20s type effect, they said, after the U.S. population unmasks, as it's in the process of doing. New York, by the way, it was just announced recently about to hit a vaccination milestone for them, and you've seen certain markets throughout the country just basically completely strip away any emergency orders, anything to do with COVID. Now, internally, RH did note what they called the largest new product introduction cycle in their history coming up in the fall. They anticipate that will also help the back half of the year in comparison to the first half. Now, all of the positive sales, all of this positive momentum, this happened despite their loss of one net gallery during the past year. Their number of outlets remained steady, 38 throughout the country. And margins, as we've talked about repeatedly, were talked about repeatedly by management. They're a major topic on the call. Their organizational goal, as I alluded to, for a full year is to stick at a 25% plus operating margin. And they feel as though they've got clear runway to do so within the next few years. They credited not only their luxury positioning in the marketplace, but a few other factors they've managed to account for internally. So not talking about those external macro factors, now talking about those internal factors. First, they noted that their elimination of seasonal inventory over the last several years, that's been a boon for them and that they haven't had to mark anything down after the seasons. And this seems like a simple enough change, but it's important to remember that this extends to such things as even color palettes for their products. And indeed, if you've been into an RH showroom lately or an outlet or even browse their website, most of their designs increasingly revolve around natural wood and metal colors. You've seen a lot of grays, a lot of browns, some golds mixed in there. So it's not seasonal colors. It's not seasonal design. They don't have those seasonal lines of product that they would later have to mark down or send to the outlets. They feel as though that is a big benefit, and that helps to drive their margins. Second, that membership model, of course, was something they also noted. They've increased their sales of spaces rather than individual pieces, which drives up ticket size. What they mean by that and what I mean by that is they're able to basically sell rooms as such. Rather than selling maybe a dining room table, they're able to sell an entire dining room table along with the rest of the collection, in part because they have a stronger connection with their members, and in part due to luxury interior designers and the connection they've forged with RH through that membership platform. Third, they noted that they're exposed to limited fashion risk in that their products tend to adhere to longer fashion cycles and are often informed by previous generations. And fourth, they noted that the luxury consumer that they are going after, well, they're not quite as harshly affected by something like, for example, a pandemic. They're not living check to check, so they can pretty much afford RH products at any time. And even though they might put a bit of cash back in that pocketbook during difficult times, overall, they see themselves as somewhat of a recession-proof retailer, at least when recessions happen, as kind of the pandemic did. Now, I want to cycle back to the fashion cycle aspect of the call, because this generated one of the more intriguing quotes that I've seen, and this took place in their letter to shareholders this past week. They said, basically, the major trends driving their business are tied to architecture and the dead. And that's a direct quote. And I'm going to quote even further here, the paragraph from the investor letter that they released. As it relates to the dead, generations pass away and their belongings move through estate sales, which feed the antique markets, which drive the high-end interior design market, which influences the high-end reproduction market, and the trends continue to flow downstream. If you want to know where the mid-century modern trend came from, do the math or visit a cemetery. End quote. That last sentence, kind of dark, maybe a little bleak, but their overall point is this. When products cycle through those antique markets and become a little bit more popular, maybe among lower-end consumers, not the highest of high-end consumers, it eventually generates high-end reproductions and styles that are informed by those styles that are showing up in antique malls. So again, mid-century moderns trending right now. RH is taking advantage of that, but it has its genesis in the fact that I guess they're saying people died of that generation and those products are now showing up in their retail stores, as well as not only in antique malls, but as reproductions. So just an interesting way to end this story, I think, but overall, they seem very well positioned. Now, of course, their stock's still trading at a very robust price-to-earnings ratio, as it has historically done over the past 5 years, although we don't talk about stock prices all that much on the show. It is noteworthy that since really those down times about 5 to 6 years ago, the stock has increased several times over. It was hovering at one point down around $30, now well over $600. So with that in mind, let's change gears on the show and shift to our interview segment. After this, we'll be joined by Justin Smith, once again a senior vice president with Lee & Associates. He'll be joining us to discuss warehouse space for retailers, particularly warehouse space as it pertains to distribution and fulfillment centers. He goes through the process behind retailers not only identifying needs in these centers, but who they work with and how they get to putting these fulfillment and distribution centers online. It's a fascinating conversation that I think you'll find interesting after this. From time to time on the show over the last 6 months, we've discussed how the ever-changing retail landscape has affected the world of retail real estate. But how has the changing retail landscape affected real estate serving retail before products hit the shelves? That is the world of industrial real estate with warehouses, distribution centers, and fulfillment facilities. And joining us to discuss the current vista of this space as it pertains to retail is Justin Smith. Justin is a senior vice president with Lee & Associates and the author of the recently released book, Industrial Intelligence, the Executive's Guide for Making Informed Commercial Real Estate Decisions. Justin, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me, Trent. Looking forward to it.
So first, just so our listeners are aware, I was wondering if you could discuss a bit about your background and then also the recent book as well.
I'm happy to. For my experience, I'm with Lee & Associates and have been for 17 years. And for those who don't know, Lee & Associates, we're a national commercial real estate brokerage firm that have retail, office, and industrial specialists and some multifamily as well. And we're in most major markets, up to 62 offices, with Nashville, Tennessee being our latest office to open with the firm. And my focus for this past 17 years has been purely on industrial, from the tenant's perspective, from the landlord's perspective, and for capital markets and investment sales. And I've noticed that our worlds with industrial and retail, right, continue to overlap to a greater degree as time goes by. And so I'm interested to talk with you a little bit more about that and explore a couple different topics and ideas today. And then for the book is all about what tenants need to know and how to run a process from A to Z when you're looking for a new building, when you're looking to extend your contract with your existing building, and then some of the vendors you meet along the way that can help you in different parts of it. It was interesting to think through things like third-party logistics and like site selection and automation, right? Those are all things that we see in retail and industrial. So to explore those even to a greater degree and then understand how those overlap has also been interesting to continue to explore as new technology emerges, adoption becomes wider, and then just with e-commerce maturing. It's a great time to be in all of these markets, and it's a great time just in like the current development with new technologies and new processes. I think it's exciting to share that with you and to explore different topics.
So you talked a little bit about these new technologies that we've seen. We've seen, of course, larger retailers partner with technological firms and the like. But I was wondering if you could take us through maybe the last 10 years of what we've seen in terms of warehouses, in terms of industrial, through a retail lens.
Happy to. The last 10 years, right? That's been some of the most exciting years for us. And I feel like e-commerce is the name for it. And what is changing, right? And what is changing is how product is now more widely available direct to consumer. And this is no strange topic for your listeners, as we've all tried to contemplate what changes as a result. So I feel like this last 10 years has just been continued iterations through retailers figuring out what is the place for the retail location, what is its purpose, and if people don't have to come to the store to pick up the product, that means you become a warehouser or you work with warehousers. So within the industrial market, that's meant that we've seen supply chains, like networks have changed, sizes of distribution centers have changed, and even strategies have changed between like a hub and spoke model where you have one large warehouse and products flowing to smaller warehouses and then to the consumer, to people being more geographic and port driven and having multiple medium-sized warehouses. And even this last 2 to 3 years with final mile or last mile delivery and with delivery times, right? Thinking through how those have changed in the past 2 to 3 years from weeks to days to hours in some cases for consumer products and for grocery and food and beverage. All of those have implications for the retailer. All of those filter into industrial in different shapes and sizes. As the back end has increased, that's kind of changed where we have warehouses and how retailers think about that. And right now, I feel like what we're on the cusp of is thinking through what that means to small markets, what that means to suburban markets, and what that means to urban markets for this last mile. And I think we're all now coming through the next kind of round of iterations of thinking through where product is made and how it ultimately gets to those three different kind of markets and how that changes the type of warehouse you might have or the size that you may have.
So you mentioned those considerations, especially as it pertains to location. And I want to dive into that a little bit further because, of course, we're used to oftentimes seeing, you know, again, the model 15, 20 years ago, these suburban warehouse locations, often in geographical hubs, in terms of serving distribution centers, fulfillment centers, and the like. But that, as you've mentioned, has really changed. What's gone on in terms of the thought process for retailers as far as how they evaluate the appropriate location for one of these facilities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like the leading edge is the demand drivers and the delivery times. That's leading to like a supply chain network analysis and more supply chain consulting. And when you think of, I'm here in Southern California, so we have a lot of product that comes from overseas, that comes through the port of Los Angeles and through Long Beach. And so if you use our area as a case study, we have the urban market near downtown LA, and we have the suburb, which is a lot of the LA basin. And then it comes out to the Inland Empire. And that's where we have land available to build our large boxes and our fulfillment centers and distribution centers. And when you think of decisions of what retailers are thinking, interestingly enough, we now have Las Vegas, right? Las Vegas has always been there, but I feel like with transportation and new models, that is seen as another location that people will look at when they think of just different states and different tax environments, different labor environments, and different regulatory environments. So I think transportation, labor, and real estate costs, right? Those are the three main pieces that retailers will look at and almost all industrial users will look at. And I feel like with every change in technology and with every change in regulation, and now the change in values for what you pay for industrial space has increased to a pace that's becoming a larger factor for retailers. Those three, it really just depends on your stores and your customers, how you take all three of those into account. But it's been interesting to see all four of those urban, suburban, tertiary, and even the interstate, like all of those different lenses through which you can look at space, and each has a different place and time for different customers and a different size.
So we've talked now about evaluation of a potential location if you're a retailer and you're looking at opening up a new, let's say, distribution center. We just talked on the show this last week about Five Below opening up a new DC here coming up in Arizona. And just from the scope of a retailer, let's say you've established the location that you want, let's say at Phoenix, Arizona, for example. This is something your book dives into really in depth. What's the process after you've chosen a general geographic location in terms of honing in on a specific spot and then developing that spot, working with leases, that type of thing? Take us through kind of the rest of the process that your book does such a great job in laying out.
You're too kind, but I agree that the details, there's so many parts of it. And so I tried to come up with the most cohesive way that's accessible to people to walk through what to do next. I find most have some location already, and they usually are then expanding. And most oftentimes starting in a lease, even in a lower cost areas, that's just what provides the most flexibility. So the way I generally think of things that's helpful for people is it's internal and external. So internally, it's all about knowing your product and your customer, right? Is that's what everybody knows, but thinking through what skills you have and what experience you have. And I think through the different functions that are in a business. So between the executive and the vision to finance, right? And so finance, what we break down in the book is a bit about budgeting and thinking through, okay, you know, you have this need, thinking through what it will take to budget for the new building is not only the cash flow of the lease payment right? Avoid the obligation you'll be taking on, but then also into the cost of the move itself. And sometimes that's getting from location A to B. Sometimes that's setting up the new building and all the infrastructure you'll need in your new building. So that's in the office is office furniture and any like a corporate design elements and team features. But then in the warehouse, right, there's so many things that could take place in your warehouse through laying it out with material handling folks and architects for what product you have, really like the shape, the packaging and the velocity of the product, I find are all important. How you're going to lay out the warehouse to know if you're going to orient vertically your pallets. And then if you can have enough velocity to introduce warehouse automation and robotics, just starting internally and then going through the warehouse. I mean, that's like literally just two of the 200 pages. But I feel like once you at least have spoken with your folks internally and passed finance, right, going into operations, that's where material handling will come in, but also like HR, IT, and legal. And so for a lot of retailers, IT is another big component to at least have had a conversation. And when you open up your next warehouse, how does that integrate into your current system? And I think through that, through the lens of inventory, of knowing what you have available to sell, in which warehouse it's located, and how you're going to allocate for sales and for delivery and for returns. And that's where if you don't have a system in place, that's sometimes where people start to mature into warehouse management systems and inventory systems, where you'll find a lot of e-commerce providers. But it's interesting to see even IT come into the picture when it comes to a warehouse. And so after you've spoken internally with the executive, with finance, with operations, with IT, with HR, with legal, then I really think to external. And external are all the service providers and the vendors and the partners that you can work with that can help you figure out how not only to set up the new building, but to know what the most modern practices are, what the most modern technologies are, what the most up-to-date costs are for these different technologies or different pieces of equipment. And so a broker is only one of those people, right, amongst the architects and the industrial engineers and the material handlers and the logistics teams. But as a broker, I find I'm often in the middle of this where I have the client who is the retailer who will need a warehouse on one side and their team and all these external vendors on the other, and really helping introduce which external vendors might be helpful. I find that's a place that I spend a lot of time in. So it's helpful to know and to have a Rolodex and a roster of those types of people. And often the feedback you get from the internal and external communications will then help guide you as you start to set up your actual project of how long is this gonna take? Is it feasible? Who is on our team? And then going to the market to know what you think you need actually exists out there. And once you see what the reality of the marketplace looks like, then that's when kind of the fun comes in of then adapting your ideal to the realities of the market. I'd say that's maybe the first third or a semi-brief introduction to the first couple of like ways that you can start to think about your project.
And that's exactly why, you know, it's funny because we talk about details, exactly why it's important to have all of this laid out as you've done in your book again. But I do want to talk about the market. Let's talk about inventory, and I'm not talking about inventory of retailers or anything. I want to talk about inventory of warehouse space, because we've heard differing things, but generally it seems like the consensus is that good warehouse space is becoming more and more difficult to come by as more companies turn towards those last mile fulfillment mechanisms rather than fulfilling through stores. As someone who deals with this on a day-to-day basis, what are you seeing as far as the overall inventory of this warehouse landscape?
On fire is the term you'll hear. And is it really on fire? I would say it's been extremely active for a long period of time, for years. And in the last year, even more so. And so the bellwether of the market, the property markets, of whether you were in equilibrium between a tenant's market and landlord market used to be 10%. And that would mean that if there was a 10% of the properties were vacant or greater, then it was a tenant's market. It was a soft market and you could easily find what you wanted. You could extract concessions from the landlord. You could negotiate free rent and discounts and improvement allowances. That equilibrium mark in the last maybe 5 years has come down to 5%. So if the vacancy factor in any given market is 5% or greater, then it's a tenant's market. And so in the past 3 years, for most major metropolitan areas, vacancy is below 5. And then even in, like, if you use again the LA basin as an example, vacancy is one of the lowest in the countries. Even when you compare, like, New Jersey, New York is also like this, but Chicago and Dallas, Fort Worth, vacancies have gone below 5. And then for LA specifically has gone down to 3, 2, 1, and in some parts of LA County, less than 1% vacant. And so what that means is finding space. How do you find it, right? So if you can't just look at the marketplace, see that there's vacancy, have your broker query what's publicly available and being advertised, then what can you do? And what that ends up resulting in is longer lead times to find what you're looking for. Finding new developments and trying to pre-lease buildings before they're completed. And then a section I cover a little bit in market engagement, and what chatter you'll hear a little bit about is the term off-market, right? Let's find off-market property. We've got to look off-market. And what I found is really common these days is what you want doesn't exist. It's not readily available. So you can't just, you know, reach your hand up and say, hey, I'd like 100,000 feet. You know, here's three of them. I'll take that one and negotiate on it. It's, I'd like 100,000 feet. Oh, there's 10 of them. All 10 are spoken for or in some phase of negotiation. So what we have had to do is brokers and advisors for property is swim upstream. And so swimming upstream means we'll contact landlords and investors, developers and landowners and other brokers about opportunities that are likely, that are possible, or that have current contracts or obligations that are expiring that will be up for negotiation again in the near future. So an example of that would be if you need 100,000 feet and it's not readily available, we would go to the landlord community, which in today's age is maybe 75% institutional. So you'll deal with public companies, with REITs, with large financial institutions, and you'll have to talk with them about their rent roll. So that's what buildings they have that are leased, that have leases expiring, and see if there's any of those where the tenant isn't going to renew. And so that's labor intensive to try and work through a bunch of different landlord relationships. And it's opaque because these aren't advertised. So that means oftentimes what you find is based on your relationship and your experience in the market. And so that's been interesting to think through when it's difficult and space is highly sought after and we can't build them fast enough. And some municipalities are starting to lessen what can be built. That just means for now it's been challenging. And so it's after having dealt with a challenging environment for long enough, you know, we adapt and we continue to find opportunities. But I've found that that's led to it taking longer to find and or causing people to have to be a little flexible. So instead of one building, you may have two. Instead of close to the port, you may be going further out from the city center. Based on all of that, that means rates have gone up. And so cost may cause you to also have to make different decisions than what you had originally contemplated.
Gives us a fantastic background, at least as far as the decision making, but also in terms of the potential lead time for a product. Well, as we kind of wrap it up here, I want to look over the next 5 to 10 years. We've talked about some technological developments to this point. What are some further developments that we might see in the warehouse space as far as retail is concerned?
I'd say warehouse automation and robotics is number one in terms of already in the marketplace and just becoming A, more widely adopted and invested in, B, new applications that can be more widely dispersed to different sizes of operations. So not just the Amazons of the world, but down into the medium and the small business. Some of the robotics as a service has been exciting to see that you don't have to buy everything, all the equipment and all the machinery. Some of that is more like you could lease it, and what you pay includes delivery and setup and maintenance. And that's kind of interesting, where you don't have to buy some huge warehouse automation equipment, own it, and have this huge cash outlay to purchase it and this huge installation. There's different applications that are more accessible, where you can try different processes out of automating at a much lower cost. So I'd say that's most near term. And then the next one out is probably autonomous driving or semi-autonomous driving as it pertains to tractor trailers, semi-trucks, and moving product from port to distribution center, from distribution center to store, and to smaller last mile facilities. And that's something we've been exploring a little bit with Waymo to get more visibility on their systems as they apply to existing trucks, and then for when it becomes more autonomous and or electric. I have to imagine that's going to have a great impact on where you locate your product and your inventory and how you keep it closer to customers. I think that will have, yeah, like a tectonic shift on the supply chain that will ripple through everybody's operations.
Once again, such a dynamic space, such an interesting space, I think, if you're anyone involved with the retail industry. Well, once again, Justin Smith, thank you so much for joining us. And really quick, if someone's interested in your book, how can they access that? How can they purchase your book?
The book is named Industrial Intelligence. It's available on Amazon and anywhere you buy books. And it's offered in paperback, hardcover, and then audio is available as well. And so however you choose to read or listen to books, it's available to you.
Fantastic. Justin, once again, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, love spending time with you, Trent. I really appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Justin for joining us, and as he mentioned, you can purchase his book or check out his book just about anywhere books are sold. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to get an advanced copy of the book, of course. We had him on the show, but I learned a lot. This is not a space I know much about. If you ask me a retail real estate question, usually I can fake my way through it. But in terms of industrial real estate, not necessarily a specialty of mine. I learned so much about the process, especially from a retailer's perspective. And so if it's something that you don't have to be involved in the industry directly, but if it's something that you're even slightly interested in, I highly recommend the book, because there's a lot more players in industrial real estate than would originally meet the eye. So we forge forward to our looking ahead segment, where we're going to discuss Home Depot. They're taking supply chain, or at least one aspect of their supply chain, into their own hands. Now, Home Depot, I should mention, is the third largest shipper in the U.S. amongst retailers in terms of global trade, in terms of ocean containers, at least Walmart and Target being the top two. Lowe's is in fourth, and Home Depot has looked at the landscape, seen supply chain disruptions over the last year plus, seen potential future supply chain disruptions with now a new variant of COVID-19 breaking out in South China, and they have purchased its own boat. It's a boat that will ostensibly ship Home Depot products, of course, but it is going to be 100% dedicated to Home Depot. This isn't a step where Home Depot is saying, oh, we're going to rent out space on the boat to maybe other retailers. No, it's 100% Home Depot boat. And vertically integrating the supply chain like this is not something that Home Depot is necessarily new to. Remember, there were rumors several years ago that Home Depot would buy the logistics chain XPO. And here we have them legitimately buying a boat, as shipping containers are more expensive, more costly to move, whether it be into the Pacific coast or the Atlantic coast here in the United States. And the reason this is a looking ahead story is not just whether or not this works for Home Depot, because I think I have pretty good faith in how Home Depot runs its supply chain. We've seen how they've run their supply chain during the course of the pandemic, and positive returns certainly there for Home Depot. But I think this is something to be interested in as far as other retailers are concerned. Other high volume retailers like Lowe's, like, for example, Ashley Furniture Home Store is number 5 on the list. You have to wonder if some of these companies don't look at maybe doing the same thing themselves and taking things under their own wing. Again, we've talked about third-party logistics firms increasing prices. They're having trouble finding staff. Of course, fuel is more expensive this year than it was at the same time last year. So a number of different pressures here in terms of supply chain, in terms of supply chain costs. Interesting to see how Home Depot not only manages the ship, whether it does provide a cost benefit to them, or if nothing else, maybe a little bit of a control benefit for them, and whether other retailers will follow suit and buy a boat. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, I'm Trent saying so long until next week for Leighton Behind the Scenes. We'll be joined next week. We're excited to have this interviewee on the show, the VP of Retail Operations at Badcock Home Furniture. Mitchell Stiles will join us. Badcock, of course, is a company with over 380 locations, mostly in the southeastern United States. Mitchell will join us to talk a little bit about the history of the company, and I know we have a lot of retail history buffs out there. You're going to find that part interesting, but also their overall unique model and how that model has driven the growth of Badcock over the last several decades. So it's a great interview. Had a lot of fun talking with him about that company. And I hope you'll join us 7 days from now for that interview and more retail news and notes.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.